Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Yesterday, the Salt Lake Tribune reported on the worrying shortage of blood on hand in area hospitals. The paper explained that Intermountain Hospital had to scrounge for blood over this past weekend as a perfect storm of circumstances led to an extreme shortage, especially of one particular blood type. But blood banks that hold blood for various health systems are significantly depleted. And, according to Dr. Walter Kelly, medical director for the American Red Cross of Utah, a lot of the reason for the shortage has to do with the pandemic.
So every summer, there's always a difficulty having enough blood donors. Just because people travel, it's a little more difficult to get people to make the commitment to come in, although we're fortunate in Utah to have a lot of very committed donors. We're in an interesting situation now because we have a lot of people who, of course, had to put off needed, but surgeries that could be delayed. And now, you know, those surgeries can only be delayed for so long. And so you have, you know, people coming in saying, I need to have the surgery, and their surgeon saying, well, of course. And so we're seeing an increase in the number of surgeries. And of course, as people are traveling more, there's more accidents, so there's more trauma. And of course, we have all of the COVID babies starting to come. So you have, unfortunately, sometimes when women give birth, you have hemorrhage with childbirth as well. So we have this sort of culmination of factors that are really hitting in frankly the worst way that I've seen in the entirety of my career.
Wow. This is sort of an obvious question, but so you mentioned one of the potential uses, but can you kind of give us the overview of how donated blood is used? I mean, it's used generally in healthcare settings and hospitals. What's it used for?
Yeah, so if you break down the use of blood, so some of the biggest users of blood are actually patients with cancer. So when we treat people, men, women, children, when we treat people who have cancer, the medicines that we give them to treat their cancer actually prevents them from being able to make blood cells. And so we need to give people receiving certain types of chemotherapy, for example, we need to give them transfusions of red blood cells. We need to give them transfusions of platelets, which are the little pieces in your blood that stop you from bleeding when you get a cut. And so, you know, since people who are receiving certain types of chemotherapy can't make those, we suppress their ability in order to treat their cancer. We have to give them transfusions in order for them to be able to receive treatment. So that's one big piece of it.
Yeah.
Another big piece of it is bleeding. And so, of course, bleeding can happen, you know, during natural processes like childbirth. And that's actually a tremendous threat both to the mother and potentially to the baby. And then, of course, we have, you know, man-made bleeding, which can be good man-made bleeding, like surgery. So if someone needs to have a heart valve surgery, for example, we need to be able to give them blood transfusions to do that surgery. And then, of course, we have bad man-made surgery, like accidents. And so if there's a motor vehicle collision, motor vehicle collisions, I've had patients use more than 200 units of blood in one patient after a motor vehicle collision. And so there's a tremendous amount of use around blood and patients that potentially need it.
Can you, I'm wondering if you can give us the basic overview of blood types. I know that, you know, for example, all of us have a blood type and some of us don't know what our blood type is, but can you give us that overview?
Yeah, for sure. So the thing I always remind people is the best type of blood donor is the type that shows up. Because if you don't show up, you can't donate. So when we talk about blood type, we usually talk about two different things. We talk about whether someone is A, B, or O, or AB, and then we talk about whether they're positive or negative. So someone, for example, that's O negative, I can take their red blood cells and put them into basically anyone, with a big caveat that I'm going to give you in a second.
Sure.
And those O negative red blood cells, that's the thing that we use if we have them when someone comes in with, you know, for example, a woman comes in with in the middle of labor and bad obstetrical bleeding. We don't have the time to know what her blood type is. And so we know that we can safely give her O negative red blood cells, for example. The same thing with a baby that's just been born. We don't know what that baby's blood type is because they were just born. And so, again, to be able to safely transfuse that newborn, we would use O negative red blood cells. And then the opposite is true. Or plasma. So when people come in with massive bleeding from, say, a motor vehicle accident, one of the things we give them very quickly is plasma. That's the liquid part of your blood. It has the proteins in it that allow you to be able to clot, to be able to stop bleeding. It's very important. And people that have blood group AB, their plasma can basically go into anyone. Now, there's a few caveats, and the biggest one is this, and this is something that I think is so important for all the listeners, especially in Utah, to hear, is that there are much rarer types of blood groups. And some of those rare types of blood groups are only present in certain ethnic groups. So, for example, I treat a few patients. There's not very many patients with sickle cell disease in Utah, but I treat a few of them with transfusion. And the specific blood types that we need to be able to treat people with sickle cell disease with transfusion are much more common in African-American blood donors than in Caucasian blood donors. Again, you know, in Utah specifically, we have a fairly large Pacific Islander population. There is a very rare blood type that I've published papers on before that occurs more frequently in Pacific Islanders. And so we need Pacific Islanders to be able to donate so that those very rare blood types can be found and used. So that's kind of the big overview of blood types.
Thank you for that. And it's fascinating. A follow-up there is, if you give blood, can you, and you don't know your blood type, can you get it determined for you? I've forgotten my blood type. Mm-hmm. That's why I ask.
Yeah, absolutely. So in fact, if you've ever given blood with the Red Cross, at least if you've given blood, you know, somewhat recently even, you can download the blood donor app. From the App Store for whatever device you use. The Red Cross has a blood donor app. You can actually sign up for a blood donation appointment. You can even on the day of your donation answer your questions ahead of time to make it faster. But one of the cool things about the app is it actually tells you if we know your blood type already, it'll tell you what it is now. And if we don't because you haven't donated with the Red Cross before, then once you donate for the first time, it will tell you what your blood type is, and it's sitting right there. Another kind of cool thing about the app, it actually tells you where your blood goes.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, you can actually, you get a little ding that says your blood has been sent to the hospital, so it's pretty neat.
That is pretty neat. So how do we find out where to give blood, Dr. Kelly?
Sure. So the easiest thing to do is to download the app.
Okay.
I actually use it myself. if you download the app, it will actually let you know, and you can go and sign up. So, for example, let's say that a civic organization is hosting a blood drive. They know, you know, what appointments have already been filled by the members of their civic organization, for example. And so, you know, you go to the app, you can actually see, oh, gosh, there's one right around the corner from me, but they don't have a spot until 3:00. And I really wanted to donate on my lunch break. And you can widen your search out on the app and see, oh, gosh, but there's one just 5 minutes farther away that has an opening that's convenient for me. And, of course, people can go to redcrossblood.org. It's all one word, redcrossblood.org. And they can search for sites there as well.
Wow. Any final thoughts? I mean, Dr. Kelly, just is there anything else we need to know about giving blood?
So I think the most important thing for people to hear is that, you know, the need doesn't stop. And, you know, we have so many dedicated blood donors and so many people that have been donating for decades now in Utah with the Red Cross. And, you know, I really want to put a special plea out to young donors and say, you know, we need you and we need you consistently. You know, maybe your parents have been doing it for years and it's time for, you know, for the next generation to step up as well.
All right. Dr. Walter Kelly, Medical Director with the American Red Cross of Utah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the help.
We'll put up a link to the app that Dr. Kelly just described with this show post, and we'll also include information on where you can donate blood that medical systems need to save lives. I'm Roger McDonough. You are listening to In the Hive here on KCPW. We're going to take a quick break and be back with something entirely different.
Are your news sources geared towards getting strong reactions from you or about keeping you informed? It's no secret that outrage can keep an information consumer coming back for more. Stories that make your blood boil and that drive wedges in society, those stories are popular. KCPW isn't here for that. We are here for you and for our community's well-being. Thank you for making that mission possible with your donation at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. I imagine you recognize what you're hearing there. Wolves. These are wolves recorded in Yellowstone National Park for Montana State University's Acoustic Atlas. Why wolves howl is a question that researchers are still kind of grappling with. one reason they might tilt their heads skyward and call out? To audibly mark their territory. Another potential reason? To individually communicate, "Here I am," to their family, their pack, a kind of call and response exercise. Wolf packs also often have a regular communal chorus, maybe as a way of saying, "We're a pack," and it could be a way of strengthening bonds within the pack unit. And then, researchers think that in some instances, howling can be used to communicate the presence or location of prey that wolves are hunting, when they hunt together as a group. Which brings us to ancient tyrannosaur dinosaurs. That's the sound Hollywood ascribes to the giant predators that roamed the Earth tens of millions of years ago. In the Hollywood version, the Tyrannosaurus Rex was a solitary hunter, terrorizing everyone and everything and clashing with other individuals of its own kind in territorial jaw-to-jaw combat. New research from dinosaur fossils found in Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, though, is challenging that depiction of tyrannosaurs. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management hosted a press conference back in April, and BLM paleontologist Dr. Alan Titus explained that the lone wolf idea, which when you think about it is kind of a misnomer, has been the prevailing version of how tyrannosaurs operated, but not necessarily the right one.
It's not particularly controversial that dinosaurs were gregarious. We find many fossil sites in which, especially plant eaters, are buried together in large numbers. So you can imagine these dinosaurs populating areas just like a herd of wildebeest in Africa today. It's a little more controversial when you start talking about gregarious predators, because predators don't instinctively or automatically become gregarious, or at least as readily as plant eaters. So when you think about predators, there really aren't lots of examples today of large predators that behave in complex social groups like wolves or lions. I mean, those are essentially the two best examples we have today. Most predators are solitary. And the reason for that is you have to have a very special purpose as a predator to want to get together and cooperate with what were originally your competitors for prey. And that involves guaranteeing success of taking down larger animals. But it also involves a lot of complex behavior. If you're going to actually share in a hunt and have roles in a hunt and have a hierarchical structure with an alpha who's in charge, that takes a fair amount of brain power, maybe a little more than it does just for a plant eater to kind of congregate for self-defense purposes or breeding purposes. So the idea that large predators like T-Rex could have actually been social, complex hunters with role-playing and division of the hunt, you know, with ambushers and chasers and then sharing in the kills and all that is somewhat controversial, because a lot of researchers feel like these animals simply didn't have the brain power to engage in such complex behavior.
Again, that's Dr. Alan Titus, Bureau of Land Management paleontologist, explaining that the common thinking has been that tyrannosaurs, like the big T-Rex you're familiar with from the movies, were solitary hunters, unlike some of the pretty social plant eaters that they may have preyed upon. However, in 2014, Dr. Titus and his colleagues discovered a fossil trove in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southeastern Utah that held the remains of multiple individuals of the Teratophonius species of tyrannosaurs. Teratophonius, by the way, is a type of tyrannosaur whose remains have so far only been found inside of the Utah Monument. Anyway, several different individuals of this same species of dinosaur of various different ages, meaning very young, adolescent, and adult Teratophonius, all together in the same place. A family, maybe? A pack? Now, these animals lived about 76.4 million years ago. The paleontologists could tell that by the geologic layer that they were found in. So just the fact that they were all in the same acre or so of land when they were discovered in 2014 doesn't necessarily mean that they had all died together. And the story of these fossils is actually extremely complicated, because the ecosystem changed around them and lakes formed over them and then dissipated. And there was a lot of scientific sleuthing to be done to figure out what exactly had happened. Because another possibility, instead of these animals having all died together at the same time, was that their individual remains had simply all been washed into the same area by river currents in the wet and forested ecosystem of the time. That they had all died in separate places and then had been brought together by the flow of water, maybe to a bend in a river, and then deposited there. The scientific sleuthing involved included analyzing stable carbon and oxygen isotopes and then looking at the concentrations of rare earth elements within the bones and rock. I'm just going to summarize the findings here to tell you that in the end, yes, the evidence from all that analysis pointed to these animals having lived and died together. They probably died in a massive flood, in fact. And just quickly, this isn't the first time that scientists have found evidence of multiple individuals of a species of tyrannosaur living together.
Slightly more than 20 years ago, Dr. Phil Curry from then the Royal Tyrrell Museum in Canada started excavating a site at this place called Dry Island Buffalo Jump in Canada, and they uncovered the remains of a minimum of 12 individual tyrannosaurs ranging in age from practically just out of the nest all the way to full adults, reaching 25, 30 feet in length. And after they studied the site and the forensic evidence on the bones, concluded that these animals had all died in a single mass kill, a catastrophic event, and that the reason they are all buried together is because they lived together. They were actually some sort of social or gregarious group of tyrannosaurs swept up in a catastrophe rather than individuals wandering into a place one after another or some sort of other mechanism to concentrate them post-death. And from this, Dr. Curry concluded that these tyrannosaurs, if they were gathering in groups and multi-generational, that they were probably behaving more like a pack of wolves than the classic solitary lone wolf predator that T-Rex had been relegated to.
There are actually now three instances of fossils from mass death events that show tyrannosaurs acting this way. So evidence is mounting to show that, you know, multiple T-Rexes may have coordinated to take down big prey and to then share in the spoils. What you're hearing now is not a recording of a dinosaur, though it kind of sounds like it. Actually, wait, yes it is. It's a Harris hawk, a species of bird that lives in parts of the American Southwest and down into Central America, and also in parts of South America. All birds in existence today can trace their origins to theropods, a meat-eating bipedal branch of the dinosaur tree. It's the same branch, by the way, that led to the rise of tyrannosaurs and velociraptors and numerous other dinosaurs that you're familiar with. So why am I suddenly playing you this modern dinosaur's very dinosaur-like call?
So Harris hawks are unique amongst birds of prey and birds in general in that they have highly evolved, very complex cooperative hunting behavior. They're very social for a hawk. And so they actually live and hunt in packs, if you want to think about it like that.
That's
Dave Oliar. I'm the director of long-term monitoring and community science at Hawkwatch International. The researchers that have studied this behavior in Harris's hawks have basically seen that the groups range from two, like a pair, like a breeding pair, up to around seven in size. And so the group will collectively meet to kind of have a kickoff ceremony before a hunt, right? So they'll meet and perch in the same area, and then they'll take off loosely together and search for prey. And they're pretty varied in the food that they take, but most of this cooperative hunting is focused on rabbits and squirrels. So, you know, larger for hawk-sized mammals. And so they'll chase jackrabbits or cotton-tailed rabbits, and they do this together. And it's almost this staged system where they'll be perched out or flying, and one hawk will take the lead and will be chasing down the prey. And if it goes after the rabbit and it misses the rabbit, you know, a trailing hawk picks up the chase, which gives the prey no chance to like rest or get, you know, catch its breath. And so they'll kind of leapfrog over each other, taking turns chasing down the prey until they can catch it. another strategy that's been documented is that several hawks will approach like one rabbit from multiple directions, right? So that there's really no direction that rabbit has to flee. Like I turn left, oh, boom. I turn right, boom. And so this kind of cooperative, coordinated hunting is really unique in hawks and birds in general. One final thing is that if a rabbit like makes it to its burrow, right, goes down into a hole in the ground to hide, one of these hawks will walk up to there and try to, you know, flush it from the hole by sticking its foot in there. But the rest of the group is surrounding it, waiting to pounce on the prey if it flushes out. Really coordinated. If you've watched documentaries like a wolf pack hunting, it's very similar to that. And they've even been referred to as the wolves of the air.
So there's a modern example of dinosaur predators hunting in groups. That's something that Dr. Alan Titus from the Bureau of Land Management pointed out this week as well.
And there is one modern example of a celurosaur dinosaur, a first cousin, essentially, or second cousin to the tyrannosaurs today, that actually organizes packs and hunts just like wolves. It's called the Harris hawk, Parabuteo. It lives in the Sonoran Desert, and they form groups of multiple individuals. They have communal raising of the young. They share in kills, and they actually have a division of labor when they hunt, and that lowers the risk to each individual bird so that they can take down much larger prey than they would normally as a lone hawk, such as jackrabbits. So this behavior is possible among dinosaurs, because here is a modern example of a dinosaur doing just what we're saying the tyrannosaurs could have done.
The kind of remarkable fossil trove that Dr. Titus and his colleagues came upon was discovered in the Kaparowitz Plateau, an extremely rich formation for fossil discoveries. But even given that richness, this particular discovery was sort of hard to believe.
We recovered so much bone from so many different kinds of animals over such a wide area, about an acre, that we nicknamed it the Rainbows and Unicorn Site. I consider this a once-in-a-lifetime sort of discovery for myself. I probably won't find another site this exciting and scientifically significant during my career, although who knows.
An improbable Rainbows and Unicorns discovery inside of Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and how it's redefining the way we think about some iconic predators from our planet's ancient past. We'll link to the research that we've been discussing in our In the Hive show post over at kcpw.org. And that does it for In the Hive today here on KCPW. You can find podcasts wherever you get your podcasts, though reach out if for some reason you can't find it, and we'll try and get that resolved. The show's theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.